made lots of fun friends over the last 24, 36 hours as we've had a chance to be here, particularly in this church with all the people who were here yesterday. And we thank you for allowing us to come to New Zealand. When the first invitation came, I prayed about it for about 8 seconds and said yes, because it had always been a dream of mine to see New Zealand and to walk some of the tracks and just drink in all the beauty that people talk about when they come here. So we've gotten just a little taste of that, and I guess it's whetting my appetite to one of these days want to come back for a longer time and really do some serious trekking. Maybe I'll be too old. Gail's at my right, and one of the things that we love to do is to talk together about subjects which are of particular importance, and the subject today is the subject that we're going to talk about. What are we going to talk about today?
Ministry marriage. The importance of the things that over 40, this is our 45th year of marriage and in ministry.
We've been doing this for 45 years?
Yeah, right so, honey.
It just seems like yesterday.
I know. And,
do you sense that there are some cynics?
I see. Somebody told us that yesterday, that there was some cynic, disposition.
So they're already showing themselves. But anyway, here we are.
Here we are. And I think it's important up front to say that no doubt there are people here who are maybe single, and we certainly want them to know that many of the concepts and the thoughts that we're going to bring are transferable. We hope that those thoughts will be helpful no matter what your station in life is, and that you will not only store them for a time when you may need them in a marital relationship, but also for the people you're helping. Gordon and I are just going to sit here much of the morning and talk to each other in dialogue and let you eavesdrop like you were sitting in our living room. And many of the things that we say are very intimate. Sometimes people say, I feel like I'm in your living room and I shouldn't be listening. But we want you to feel free.
What are you planning on saying?
Well,
go on, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Okay.
I just get so turned on when you talk.
But the importance...
Keep going, you're on a roll.
Oh, stop. The importance of this time for us is not to be people who are just speaking the gospel, but being the gospel. And I was thinking this morning of 1 Thessalonians 2:8. You want to put that on the screen and...
There it is. You say it and it just gets...
Just like that. That we loved you so much, Paul says to the Thessalonian church, that he was delighted to share with them not only the gospel, but his very life as well. And what Gordon and I are going to be doing is trying to share 45 years of learning the hard way in many cases, and let you, we hope, assimilate, and by listening to us talk, we'll find ways to say things to each other in the hours ahead where there might be a need for understanding and growth.
Yeah, and I think I just want to tease out something that you said, because there's a difference between preaching, which we're not going to do, and dialoguing. We're going to talk. And as we talk, we know where we're going and the points we want to make. But there's a lot of spontaneity here, as we'll probably learn in the next few minutes. But I'm aware that I have my back turned to about a third of the crowd, and you have your back turned to a third. And
you're going to keep turning around, aren't you?
Every once in a while.
Yes.
I will promise to do that. But let's get on with the subject and chat for... We already have technological problems.
Excuse me. Can I just take off your
seat? Oh, yeah. Put it in the back. Okay. Good. Thanks, Jeanette. I'm sure glad you're doing the detail thing here.
I'll get started.
Thank you.
Some years ago, Gail and I went to Moldova, which is a part of the old Soviet Union, and spent about 2 weeks with the Christians there. And I've trained Gail over the years that when we travel, we travel as light as possible. We haven't done that as well coming to New Zealand this time, but we generally travel light, and when we went to Moldova, we were lighter than normal, which always compounds as a problem when you get to the airport and all the Christians come to say goodbye and they bring a whole bunch of gifts for you. And you got to find a place for them. And one of the things that they gave us when we got ready to leave Moldova years ago was something, and many of you will have seen this and maybe even own one, something called a Matryoshka doll. It's a doll that's particularly indigenous to Russia and to the countries around it. It's one of those dolls, you know, a doll within a doll within a doll within a doll. And if you get a real expensive one, you can get about 10 of these little babies inside of each other, and it's just a well, ours was as ugly as sin. And we brought it home, and it kind of sat off to one side, both Gail and I trying to figure out for the longest time what in the world we're going to do with this monstrosity. And one day, in an idle moment, I pulled it out, and I separated all the dolls until there were 7 or 8 or 9 of them in a row, from the largest to the smallest. And I began to think, there's got to be a sermon illustration here someplace. And then, in an instant, it came to me. There really was a very profound message in this set of dolls. Now, we didn't bring our Matryoshka doll with us to New Zealand. And so what you're seeing here is a very weird set of coffee cups that Gail went to the kitchen here at the church and found, just so we could give you a visual demonstration of the point that we'd like to start up with this morning and make. If you can imagine a Matryoshka doll right here on this little table. Some of you in the back row have a rough time seeing. Shall I just go on and explain this for a minute?
Sure, go ahead.
You don't mind? I have my back turned to you. You're not offended.
I can live with that.
Well, here was the largest of the dolls, the one you see right at the very beginning. And then there was a smaller and a smaller and a smaller, until you get down, literally in our Matryoshka doll, the smallest one is about an inch tall. So they go from here all the way down to here. And I looked at it and I said to myself, that's Gordon. That's Gordon 1, Gordon 2, Gordon 3, 4, 5, and 6. This is the Gordon that everybody sees if they spend a few seconds looking. It's the Gordon that you're looking at right now. You size Gordon up by the clothes he's wearing, how you're already admiring my great athletic body, and you're judging me by my tone of voice and the way I talk, and so you've come up with some first impressions. But that's about all you know about me, is what Gordon 1 wants you to know. You don't know Gordon 2. Gail knows Gordon 2 very, 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 very well. Sometimes I think she knows Gordon 2 better than I know Gordon 2. And if you spend a number of hours with me, and if we get along well, and there's a congeniality between the two of us, the possibility is you too will get to know the inner Gordon that I call Gordon 2. But then there's Gordon 3. Gail knows him fairly well. I know him better than she knows him. And he's pretty prominent and active in my life.
What does he say to you? He says things like, put your seatbelt on.
Well, he may be a... let me come back to that in just a second.
Oh, all right.
Gordon 4 is very elusive, and you rarely get to see this guy. I know who he is, but I'm not sure I always am in touch with him. Gordon 5, no one has ever met. I know him a little bit. And I'm not even sure that Gordon 6 is converted. He is so deep inside of me that all I know is that I get some messages from somewhere, and they're messages I often shouldn't hear or don't want to hear or don't like to hear, and I just know he's down deep inside of me, but he's awfully hard to figure out. Jeremiah may have been thinking of him when he once said, the heart is deceitful and wicked above all things. Who can figure it out? And that's Gordon 6. Paul had two Pauls in Romans 7. The good that I would, I don't do. And the things I don't want to do, I end up doing. And so he, 20 centuries later, we got 6 or 7 Gordons and only 2 Pauls. But
I think wasn't it Buechner who said that we have a committee of selves?
Yeah, a committee of selves, all of which would like to be in charge.
And the question is, in marriage, when you have 6 Gales and 6 Gordons, you got a lot of stuff in there that is going on that neither one wants to show the other one for years and years and years. It's hidden because we don't feel safe for a multitude of reasons. And the overarching hope in a ministry marriage is that all of us will find a safe haven in each other, because we first found it in Christ. And that's what we want to give to each other. But until we have a safe haven, many of the inner people that that we know are there because of past unrepaired parts of us, we're just waiting to find out whether that other person is willing to receive us as we are with all of those, that baggage?
That's really an important point you're making. That's worth the price of the day right there. Because when you and I first met, it was Gail one meeting Gordon one. And I guess we liked what we saw. But in those first weeks and months, that was about all we knew of each other, was Gail one, Gail two, Gordon one, Gordon two. And so what you're saying, and I just want to emphasize it, is that it took years for these Gordons and these Gales to show themselves.
And one of the things we want to show this morning is how that unraveled in our own lives, and the hope that other people will begin to ask each other, what are the things in your life that you're afraid to tell me? Because I'm not safe. And that takes a lot of risk in any marriage. But if it doesn't happen in the pastor's home, if it doesn't happen between friends, it's never going to happen in the congregation, because as the leader, so the people. And so this is a even though it's kind of humorous, those cups, really, honey. But it's still an important concept.
Well, let me take you back to a comment you made a little while ago, because you were starting down another line that's very important. What if Gordon 4 doesn't like Gordon 1? What if one of these six dolls or persons is an assassin and is doing everything that he can do to blast the other five Gordons out of the water?
There's no question that that goes on in a lot of pastoral lives. I think there was a time in your life where you would admit you had a someplace down in there, you had a death wish for this number one, because the death wish would get you out of ministry.
I think a lot of men and women in leadership have at least one self inside of them that's hostile to everything that's going on. Now, if you put this into a relationship, it's not only Gordon 1 dealing with all the other Gordons, but it's Gail dealing with all the other Gales, and then it's the Gordons against the Gales, all trying to find alignment and trying to find something that will make this relationship work. And I said this to you just the other day as we were talking about this thought, that sometimes we are often astounded at relationships that don't make it. Maybe we need to think for a moment about the amazement that any relationships do make it. Because there is such an attitude often of conflict and unalignment, and down the line, lack of communication, as these Gordons and Gales begin to reveal themselves.
And we assume, because we're Christ followers, that these things are just going to fall into place. And it takes years and skill and unselfishness for us to plumb the depths of each other. And I think that's one of the reasons, too. You have to go back to Genesis 2 to see the kind of safety that was in the garden. The a willingness to be who they were, and an openness without fear. And we are so far. Our shame is so great. And many of us came to the gospel out of such a need for wholeness. And yet that's been perhaps cut short, because we got into ministry and we've had to deal with other people's stuff.
Mm-hmm.
This is a day for us to think about where we are in our relationships.
Let's talk about that Genesis 2 thing for just a moment, because there's some lines there that are absolutely beautiful. They're almost poetic. As they describe the relationship between the first man and the first woman, the first line is the one around the 18th verse that says, God saw that it was not good that man was living alone. I really agree with God on that one. That makes a lot of sense to me. So then you have this continuation of the story where the first man is put to sleep, and out of his body comes this bone. And when he awakens, he looks at someone who is his counterpart. She's not him. She doesn't look like him. But somehow he recognizes that he is complete with her. And he cries out in what I think is the first love song. At last, this is bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh. She should be called woman. She's taken out of man. I don't want to get too syrupy here, but, you know, as a young guy, I longed for that moment. I just couldn't wait for the moment that a person would cross my path that would complete me, and that somehow would see value in me that no one else saw. And you remember the Saturday morning that you and I met for the first time? We had this common friend who was much older than us, a godly man. And the night before, he had said to me, Gordon, I've met a wonderful young woman who would make you a great wife.
Well, actually, I was dating him, yes.
Why did you have to bring that up?
But he was too old for me, you're right. But he was your mentor.
Well, I'm thinking about this now. Was he really? Okay, anyway. So anyway, he tells me all about you, and the next morning we go over to your place and have breakfast. And remember those first 30 minutes?
Well, again, because there was a like vision that both of us had sensed a call to ministry, and we knew where we were headed. You have to know first who you are. Then you sat down at my piano, and I went over, and we started singing, and poor Keith over here who had introduced us.
What was his name again?
Yeah, what was his name? Yeah, I think we forgot about him very, very quickly, but there was that that feeling of at last. Actually, we were engaged 3 weeks later. Whoa, we don't say that when there are teenagers in the room. But
go on and tell them the rest.
And married 4 months later. And so that's a...
But that was possible for several reasons. First of all, because there was a man we both trusted who blessed the relationship from the very beginning.
He was our introducer.
He really was.
In the Asia culture.
So you have the confidence of someone older than you that says, this is a good thing. And then you were really the first woman I ever met who had this strong sense of call to, you know, today we call it a purpose-driven life. And you did have a sense of purpose. And it was fabulous to see how totally in alignment that was with what my sense of purpose was in that day. So that made it possible for us to join lives quicker than normal.
And this is not the norm, I don't think, today. I think that today many people they're married, and the husband is very called, and often the wife feels, well, I'll support him, but that's not me. And so there is a great diversity in this, and our situation is certainly not the norm.
Or let me give you another version of that. The man feels called to the ministry, and the wife just kind of comes along for the ride.
Sometimes kicking and screaming.
Especially if he has chosen, you know, we're using the male terms right now, but especially if he chose to go into the ministry after they got married.
Yes.
She may have married a business person or a professor or whatever, and then didn't really want to go into
it. And he or she changes the rules in the middle of the game. It's not fair, and it takes a lot of adjusting to get to that place where all of a sudden you're catapulted into a ministry life.
You know, when I think about those early weeks and months, you know, we kind of romanticized it for a moment and said it was all great, but there was another side to it that has to be brought into it if you're going to make sense out of this, and that was the fact that both of us came out of family backgrounds that didn't lend themselves well to our having a positive view of marriage.
Yeah, and I think you were going to show the quote that I think enunciates many of the things that are happening in those earliest times.
You know, I was going to do that,
yeah.
And I'm so glad that you reminded
me.
Thank you for having a good attitude about that, you blew that line. I never mind being rebuked.
Good.
There's a writer, in fact, he just died a couple of months ago, by the name of Basil Pennington from the U.S., and he made an incredible statement in one of his later books. He writes, "We are broken persons and live in broken communities in a state of brokenness. We are alienated from ourselves and from one another. We don't readily fit together." Look at the dolls. "We're like a bunch of porcupines trying to huddle together for warmth, but who are always driven apart out of the fear that we can wound the wounds we can inflict upon each other with our quills." You go back, and that really, in some small sense, is a story of our coming together in those early months in life. We had this great desire to huddle together, and yet we were sinners. And so you bring into the situation, as we'll talk later on today, the differences and all the character patterns, which at first look like they're very, very compatible, but over time begin to show themselves to be sometimes even destructive.
Well, and Pennington's quote really takes us into Genesis 3, doesn't it? Because now shame and guilt and blame has entered the picture, and we're living with the consequences of that.
You got me back to Genesis again, didn't you? Yeah.
So, you forgot Genesis.
I forgot. So let's go back to Genesis for a second. How casual this is?
Is this a part of your aging process?
Yes.
Okay.
The man and woman look at each other, and that beautiful phrase, he shall leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife, the old King James. But the real word is hesed, or devoted. He shall devote himself, give himself to his spouse. and the two shall become one flesh. Those are incredible words. That the key to a healthy relationship is this ability that God has given to human beings, unlike any other living species, to commit themselves, to give themselves in total solidarity with one another. And then that final phrase, and the two were naked and unashamed, which probably expresses the deepest desire of the soul, that someone would know me so deeply that I would be willing to not just unclothe myself physically, but unclothe myself to the level of my soul.
That's a safe haven marriage right there. And we are, every one of us in this room would have to admit that there are very few safe haven marriages in ministry. At least that's our perception in our country. And the women and men that we deal with across the country and other parts of the world. And that's what we have to think about. Why are the porcupine's quills winning in our relationships? And a lot of it has to do with our public life. I had handed to you a minute ago George Barna. I don't know if any of you ever read George Barna, who does a lot of surveys of ministry people in the States. Came out recently with one of his figures is that 80% of ministry men or women who are in ministry say 80% said that ministry has had a negative effect on their family. 80%. Now we have to unpack that and ask, why is that so?
Well, you and I would never have believed that number in our earliest months, weeks together, because we had such a high view of all the possibilities. We both came out of families, as I was going to say a few moments ago, that really had a lot of dysfunctionality to them. If you list in our extended family, there was overt homosexuality, there was multiple divorces,
wife swapping.
Suicide, alcoholism. That's enough to say there's something wrong here.
Yeah, and if you looked at that family profile and put it up on the screen, you'd say this marriage probably has maybe a 1/4 of a chance to make it, because these people were never taught relational skills. And so when you and I did marry, I can remember us talking, let's put a stake in the ground and say, we're going to start a new thing. Otherwise, we're just going to repeat the generational problems that come down almost in the DNA of the way people have learned to respond to each other. And so people look at us after 45 years and say, well, yeah, you don't know what we've gone through. Right. This is work. And it's joyful work, but it's also it's work.
Well, I've had occasion this week to observe two or three couples who have been married less than just a few months. And, you know, when you're the old guy, you look at them and you're thrilled for the freshness of their love and affection for one another. But you just know that over the next many, many years, they're going to make layer after layer after layer of discovery with each other. And those discoveries are either going to delight them and bring them great challenge to growth and depth, or those discoveries are going to slowly erode the relationship until one day the power of it will be lost. It's their call and their choice to make. But in those first weeks and months, there's so much that I'm not sure we knew. I remember when our introducer, Keith, realized that we were really going to make this a marriage. And he took me out to lunch a few weeks before the wedding. I know he had confidence that you could handle things, but I could see his confidence in me eroding. I was by far the less mature of the two of us. And he said something to me that was very, very profound. It may have been one of the most important two or three pieces of advice I ever got in my life. He said, Gordon, God has allowed you, apparently, to marry a thoroughbred of a woman. Remember that statement?
You all like to be that, wouldn't you, ladies?
Well, it's guy talk. You know,
Oh, yeah.
It's the way men talk when the women aren't around. But here was his point. He said, God means to give you many gifts through her. He has many things to say to you through her. He has many things to show you through her. Listen to her. And you know, as I look back on that moment, I'm realizing that if he hadn't given me that piece of advice, I'm not sure, as a young, arrogant, know-it-all kid of 23, that I would have known what that meant. I have seen so many young men who have just turned off their ears to their spouses, who have not seen the value of what the woman had to give them. And so when the advice came, or the correction came, or the insights came, they just blew it off. And you and I know us very, very well how many women we have seen in the ministry context who finally, after 8 or 10, 15 years of trying to help and to support and to give, finally say, I'll just put my energies in other directions because he's not a listener. And that's when you see a recipe for disaster. And I think I would have been one of those guys if this wonderful man, whom we both loved and trusted, had said that. I remember going away from that day saying, there's a message here I've got to take seriously. And over the years, I began to realize how powerful that advice came into being again and again and again because God used you in so many different ways to help me become the kind of man I am today.
Your willingness to be teachable was a great, great gift to me because I am a nurturer by nature, and I love to build in each in a person's life. And, of course, your close friend and lover is the one you want to build in. And if you had resisted, there is something that dies inside of a woman when a man resists. I've often thought of love as a moving thing. It goes in a circle. And as long as one person is giving the love and it's received, the circle, like electricity, keeps going. But when love is given and the other doesn't receive it, it stops mm-hmm. it. And I'm sorry. And things like that have to be said in order to get the current going again. And so many times we have that current stopped for days and days and days because someone has shut the other one off.
Well, you know, you're describing the kind of home I grew up in. Because my father didn't have the capacity at all to listen to my mother. I'm not sure what wisdom my mother would have brought to my father if he had listened, but I'll never know. All I know is that from the earliest days on, it was two people moving slowly in separate directions. Oh, she could play the piano, and she could look pretty and charm the people in the church. And he could preach whiz-bang sermons. But there was very little to learn from their relationship. They weren't giving to each other with any significance at all from the very get-go.
No, and they expected you to be the one who brought them together. You were in the middle here.
Well, that's a marriage where the children are the only binding agent, aren't they? But, you know, you take that piece of advice which Keith gave to me, and you begin to multiply it, and you have the potential of a relationship. And that's why one of the ways you and I have learned to look at our own marriage journey is in terms of the themes of the gifts that we've been able to bring to each other. And, you know, we've come to believe, haven't we, that in every relationship, whether it's a marriage or a friendship, there are gifts to give. And that we have a perfect right to expect in a God-blessed relationship that gifts are going to be exchanged. Like, for example, the first major gift you gave me, apart from that first kiss, which I'll never forget, but the first gift you gave to me was the first night I got a chance to preach. We'd known each other maybe 6, 8, 9 weeks now. We were in love. I'd put a ring on your finger. And one night I'm asked to speak at a church with about 40 people. It's one of the very first times I've ever done this kind of thing. And you're sitting in the front row, proud, supportive, and I do my thing. I will never forget the end of that evening. I'll never forget this. When everybody left, and you and I went out a side door to our car, and the minute we were alone, you threw your arms around me, and you kissed me, and you said, God has given me a vision tonight of the kind of preacher he wants to make you into. And I thought, I'd never heard anything like that before. No one had ever really gotten behind me and said, there's a preacher in you until that night. And I've often thought your kiss made me a preacher because you're saying to me those words, they just washed me with value and with possibility. And made me realize maybe there was a future to this call that I felt God had given to me. You remember that night?
I remember that night because as I sat there and listened to you, the Holy Spirit, it's not audible, but there is this thought that comes through your heart. And this was, I'm going to use this man Know when to come near and when to back off. Those are the words. When not to nurture and when to nurture is the way I heard it. But always being there as a support. And I've held on to that for 45 years. I mean, I believe that with all my heart, that my role is also important, that the support role, and you've never let me just stay at support. You've pushed me out and do more, growing. But that is enough for me in life because I believe it's God's gift. So the affirming of each other's gifts, we can't overestimate that. And as people sit here today, I hope they're asking the question, am I affirming the gifts in my friendships and in my marriage? Because it's the place that Jesus began with the disciples and with everybody he met. And Paul even begins with affirmation before he hits people over the head. He always starts with the affirmation.
Well, I don't want to over-exaggerate this to the point that it sounds like, you know, I'm being untruthful, but it, when I look back at those days at the age of 23, it seemed to me you were the first person to believe in me. I know a lot of people, men
and
women.
Well, your grandma and your mama believed in you.
Yeah, but that, you know, grandmother, mother. But you came along in those days, and I remember those conversations we would have long into the night. And, you know, I felt, you talk about safety. You were the first person I felt safe to talk about things I hoped for, things I hoped that God was going to do in my life, what the possibilities might be. And you'd listen to all those dreams, as crazy as they were, and you'd I can see how that could happen. You'd have to do this. And for the first time, I felt a partnership in the kind of dreams that were so important. And it seems to me that's one of the great first building blocks of a relationship. Can people dream together? Do they see potential in one another? Do they see value? Can they put words to it? Can they let one another know that they see possibility?
It goes both ways. In order for it to stay alive, so that we don't start hiding in one of those lower selves. Well, it was also for me, I guess the whole idea of sensitivity was something that came very naturally to me, because when I first became a Christ follower as a teenager, I began to pray for an understanding of what people were not saying, but what they felt very deeply, what they longed for.
The deeper dives.
Yeah, because if you think about it, most of us will not tell each other what we really want. We're hoping the other person hears the wish. Sort of like when David wished for the water in Jerusalem, and those mighty men heard the wish. And we're hoping, because we're supposed to be in a devoted relationship, that that person will hear the little hints I give and read my mind. This is what I wish you'd do. Pick up the dishes. Pick up your clothes. You know, little wishes like that. And if you think about it, what we're doing for people in the congregation all the time, we're trying to be sensitive to their needs. But if it doesn't start at home, home is where you hone your gifts. And the overflow of it is in the congregation.
You need to put on that back again.
What do I need? Oh, sorry.
Well, so, when we first met, I was probably one of the most insensitive people that came along, because I was really good at reading people on the surface level. You were three or four levels down beneath me.
Well, I think that's because you left home at 13 and, you know, went to prep school. And so you didn't have those understandings. But again, if you think about, go back to the kinds of things that people are saying in the congregation. People who used to sit near the front, all of a sudden, they go to the back. Well, what does a sensitive person see in that? They're trying to tell me with their body how they're feeling about God. Why the move? Well, I can't tell the preacher that I'm out of fellowship, but I'll tell him with my body. Or a person who used to come up and shake your hand, and he stopped shaking your hand, or look you in the eye, and he's no longer looking you in the eye. Well, in marriages, you have all of that. Things I can't tell you kinds of stuff, too, because someplace anger has cropped up and we have cut each other off, and so sensitivity begins to die.
Yeah, well, they don't teach you that in seminary, you know?
No.
But I remember that those first years, those first months, we would go to a Bible study or a party or a program, and on the way home you would say to me, didn't you hear what she was really trying to say? Or didn't you see what was going on between the two of them, the way they separated from each other on the couch? Or didn't you feel the mood that that group was falling into as the evening went by? And I get so frustrated. I say, no, I didn't feel that mood, and no, I didn't hear what she was trying to say, and no, I didn't see what they were doing. But I'd go back and check the next day, and it was so frustrating. You were always right. And so, you know, there's a point where a man, if it's the man involved, has to determine, am I going to learn from this, or am I going to just turn this off because I don't have it and she does?
Yeah, and you could have turned me off then, and you could have said, look, I'm the leader here. You bug out. But you didn't. You said, here is a gift. This woman can help me. That's all she wants to do. And so you begin to ask me, what'd you hear tonight? What was underneath that needs to surface? And so that was a marvelous gift, acceptance that you gave. You received it.
Well, I'm not sure I would have made it in the ministry if you hadn't taught me how to read the deeper signals of people. I'm not even sure I had that language or that thought form when I was a young person. But watching you do that and perceive that was an incredible learning experience for me. And you know, years later, it's a second sense for me. But I had to learn it from somewhere. And that's a perfect example of how two people in a relationship become teachable to each other.
Well, one of the things that you taught me, the gifts that you gave to me, was teaching me that I could be wrong and say sorry, because I was bruised.
You had to learn this?
I had to learn this, and we have to underscore that it took 9 years into our marriage, and the dolls, how deep this hurt that I had sustained from a broken engagement, and also from a daddy and a brother who temperamentally were very different from me and often abandoned me when I needed them emotionally. And so I had learned to fear being wrong, because this in the engagement, this man dumped me three months before the wedding, and so I thought, well, you know, if Gordon ever finds out that I'm wrong about things, he may leave me too. You know, the mind, you don't even think cognitively about this; it's subconscious, but it's having its effect on you. And until you feel safe enough with this person that you're married to say, there are reasons why I can't say I'm sorry, I'm wrong. Please stick with me in this. And you would so often, you would say to me, honey, look, I'll take the guff on this. Why don't you just say, I'm sorry, it was my fault. Now, I'll say it, and then you repeat after me.
I do remember those first years. You know, now we're talking about Gale 3 and Gale 4.
Or deeper.
But I can remember if we had a disagreement or a conflict, and we did have those, it just seemed like whether the issue was small or large, it was such an effort for you to come to grips with the reality of the situation. And I felt badly for you, because I grew up being wrong all the time. Saying sorry was no problem in the world for me in my family. But for you, I could just see something in you that just fought that. It was a real challenge.
It was just the fear of abandonment, and I didn't realize that for years and years and years, way past the ninth year of marriage.
But, you know, that could have divided a relationship, that issue right there, if both of us hadn't approached it with some patience and taken the time to learn what's behind this behavior, what's underneath it that reflects time from the past, and we'll talk more about that later. But that is such an important dimension that we need to keep saying it over and over again. Sometimes these things take years to learn.
Yeah, and your mercy during that time is what made it possible for me to ultimately come to the day when it's like I like to liken it to the shade going down in the heart. You know, when I got that Dear Gale letter calling off our engagement, because that man had led me to Christ, and because his family was my bridge to Jesus, he became too important to my faith. And so when he dumped me, it was like I just kind of pulled this shade in my heart and said, no man's ever going to get to me like that again. Some of you out there, women, you've done the same thing, and some of your shades are still down. because you're terrified that somebody might hurt you to the core like that again. And because often we women are in I don't mean this pejoratively, but we're in the more submitted role. Ask us out, and that kind of thing. At least in our generation, that was the way it was. Men had the leadership. If we get dumped, and it gets dumped many times in our young life, I'm telling you, it has a huge effect on how we relate. Then you have a public marriage where you know it's important to say you're sorry, and you cannot do it. You're the pastor's wife. What's wrong with you? Hmm. I could tell our children I was sorry because they were young, and I had a clean, fresh start with them. But to tell you the thought of you abandoning me? So, your mercy. Over and over again, when I should have been adult enough to be able to say that, your mercy was the thing that made my life livable.
Let's go back to the story of the dolls again for just a moment, because to put in another way what you're saying, in many relationships, even in a marriage relationship, in effect what we say is, I'm only going to be married to you on Gordon 1 level and Gordon 2 level, but I'm probably never going to let you meet Gordon 3, 4, and 5 because they're too vulnerable, they're too hurtable, they've been hurt too many times, and I'm not going to take the risk that you'll hurt. So safety for me will be just showing you the first two dolls. And it takes years for us to get to know the other dolls and things. Let me move us along to another gift, because you mentioned the magic number 9 years, and sometimes you and I have come to the conclusion that it takes about 9 years to really start descending into the deeper dolls. But do you remember that springtime in our 9th year of marriage when we made this drive for about 1,000 miles from a vacation spot to our home? And the children, we now had children, were asleep in the back of the car, and you were reading to me from a very extensive biography of William and Catherine Booth. And we've reached the point where Catherine is dying of breast cancer, and her death is a slow, suffering death where her chest cavity is open, the smell in the room is beyond comprehension, there's no surgery, they've elected not to do that. It's only a matter of time, and the only person who can bear to be with her for long periods of time is William, and he sits there and he holds her in his arms and he caresses her and he loves her and he whispers endearments into her ear hour after hour, and you're reading this to me.
I'm reading it, and because it's such a large 800-page biography, it tells you every gruesome detail. And as I read, I begin to sob. Now, you, in 9 years of marriage, you have never seen me sob. And you're sitting over there driving this car, and you have, in that split second, a big decision to make. You can either cut me off and say, you know, stop this makes me nervous. Or you can say, honey, what's happening here? And you choose to say that. You say, what is this story bringing you to?
That moment may be one of a dozen moments in a relationship over 10 years where you make a turn to the right or a turn to the left and things will never again be the same. It makes me wonder how many of those moments we miss where the other person was on the edge of opening something about themselves at a deeper level, and the other person mishandles the moment. They blow them off, they laugh at them, they say something humorous, they turn their attention to other things, but the moment collapses just like that. Fortunately, in this moment, somehow the Holy Spirit gives me the smarts to say to you, what's going on here? Why these tears?
And I say, no man would ever love me like that. No man would ever love me like that. Which was just hearkening back to the story that I told a moment ago about this broken engagement. And in that moment, the shade goes up. And Gail says, in effect, this is a safe haven marriage. I can tell this man something that has been bothering me for years. I really, today, believe I can trust you with this.
Well, let's repeat ourselves for about the 10th time now. It took 9 years to get there. And you know, I've known about the broken engagement ever since the first day I met you, but I'd never understood what the broken engagement did to you. I'd known the kind of man your father was, and I knew the kind of man your older brother was, but I had never appreciated to this point the effect that they had had upon your soul. It took 9 years for me to figure that out and decode it. And now it all comes out in this story in the card.
So you went inside yourself like a good little introvert.
Well, let me tell you what was going on there. I mean, you say to me, no man would ever love me like William loves Catherine. And I'm saying to myself, my gosh, I thought I'd been loving her for 9 years. Are there deeper ways to love her than I knew about until now? That's a powerful question. Are there deeper ways to love? Because I think you and I know enough about marriage now, as we've seen it in hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of relationships, that a lot of people formulate a politic of loving in the first few years, and then they try to repeat that for the rest of their lives without ever recognizing that every year brings new ways of loving. If you've been in a marriage for 20 years, you better be loving at a 20-year level. But too many people at 20 years are loving each other at a 4-year level, and it doesn't work.
Especially in ministry, because it's so obvious to everybody.
Sure.
The depth of your love.
You see the deadness of the relationship, the staleness, the boredom of it all. And my gosh, no wonder the younger generation today looks at the older generation and says, who wants to get married? I don't see any examples of love that endures and is sustainable and is fresh in its 40th or 45th or 50th year. So, here I am in my 9th year saying, how do I love her more than I've loved her before? And you're right, I did go inside of myself. Rather than try to make a lot of promises and pledges to you that day to protest your comment, it seemed to me it was something I had to think about. And for the next days, I thought and I thought and I thought. And one of the things that came to me was, well, maybe I'd get my answer if I asked myself the question, how does Gail love me? That's an interesting way to find out how to love someone. Ask how they love. And when I wrestled with that question, I began to realize that you had very, very systematically explored my life as you knew it and found out all the things which were of priority importance to me and then asked yourself, how can I support and build and encourage and get behind that? Obviously, you saw me wanting to be a preacher and you knew that my sermon every Sunday was one of the most important events of my week. And so what had you done? Well, in the Friday-Saturday period when I did most of my prep, you made sure that I got free of interruptions. You kept the kids away from bothering me. And on Sunday morning when I got up early to cram, you'd bring a breakfast tray to my desk. And when I left the house to go to the church for the early service, you'd put your hands on me and pray for me. And then in both services, you would be in the front row with your Bible open and your notebook open, taking notes on everything I said, as if to say to the congregation, here's how you listen to a sermon. And best of all, when the sermon was over, for the next 24 hours, you didn't criticize it.
You notice he said 24 hours.
But here's the point. I had never consciously ever asked myself, what's the equivalent in Gail's life to my sermon? What are the things which are most important to her that deserve my support? And when I began to think about love in that perspective, whole new realities came to me. For example, I realized that at that point in our lives, you're mother of two children. We've chosen for you not to work in terms of income generation. Your sermon is your home. It's the way you decorate it, the way you make sure every day it has an aura of hospitality and warmth and reception. No one loved to come to our home more than me each night. And everybody else that came there felt safe because you had this gift, this wonderful ability to make what little we had into something that was very wonderful to be a part of. But I would come through that door, and the first thing I would do, because of the kind of person I was, is I'd throw my sport coat over the first doorknob and a shoe in the living room and a shoe in the hallway and my keys on the table, my sunglasses in the kitchen, and if I went into the bathroom, I left the toilet seat up, and when it got time to go to bed at night, I'd leave all my dirty clothes, strewn all over the place.
Yeah, I could find you, though. You left that trail. Well,
I guess you could. But
you know what happened.
But let me just tie this together and say, what I was doing with all of that sloppiness was I was stomping all over your sermon. It was as if when I preached, you had stretched out in the front pew and told people, look, wake me when it's over. I've heard it before. It's not that good. But I was not paying any attention to your sermon. And one way of loving you would be to ask, what does a woman who keeps a home like this want from me to support what she's doing? And obviously the answer is as simple as organize yourself. Pick up after yourself. I made the commitment. I'll never go to bed at night without making sure that everything in this home that bears I have responsibility for is put in its appropriate place. That simple little gesture, it turns out, is an act of love, isn't it?
Well, I felt like overnight you changed. You became this neatnik. And you didn't ever say to me, I've made a decision, which is your way of doing things. You go inside, you think about something, you make a decision, and rather than make promises, you do it and let someone find it out by the action, not by your words, which I think is biblical. And so I felt so loved. I felt like, oh, I don't have three children to pick up after anymore. I've only got two.
Thanks for that. I really needed that.
Well, I know that sounds bad, but that's the way sometimes a woman feels. And when all of a sudden this person that you love sees that this is, you want to be his lover, not his mother.
Now, what are you saying there? Because that needs to be teased out for a moment.
Well, mothers pick up after their children. It's part of life. But when you're living with an adult, you feel like an adult ought to be able to pick up after himself. And that's just an intuitive thing to a woman. And so it gets resentment coming up inside of her, especially if she's gainfully employed outside of the home and she has to come home and do that again. And so what you did for me was he got that love going in a whole new way, and I wanted to outlove you then, which is the way love works. The more that one gives to the other, then the next one says, well, I should be able to do more to love too. And that happens.
I guess in a sense you begin to spot more sermons, don't you?
I do.
And you now your love jumps from that first phase romantic love, which is all about attraction, to now a love which is deeper than just attraction. It's a love of support. It's a love of delight. It's a love of discovery, helping the other person become more of what they are meant by God to be. And, you know, over the years, how many people have we entertained in our home who were blessed by God, converted to Christ, deepened in their own sense of call, but it was because of your sermon in our home that this became the environment in which that could be done. And so now that the two of us support that sermon, a lot more gets done.
One of the things that a gift that you gave me when the children were now maybe 7 and 10, one day they came home from school and dropped their books on the table and were out of there, and I used to love the moment they came home because I'd get my debriefing, how was school, and now they were starting to get into the grunt years, how was school, okay, you know, and was what was nothing, you know, that kind of stuff. And Charlie Shedd calls them the cave years. You have to go in the cave and grab the kid out and get them to talk. But I remember you happened to be home that day, and I turned to you and said, the children don't need me anymore.
That's another one of those up-the-shade moments.
Yeah, it was.
It's a sentimental statement. It's maybe an exaggeration. We both know it's not really true, but it expresses a sigh, a wistfulness in your heart. And if the other person is hearing things, it's a moment where you want to say, let's go with this for a moment and ask what it means.
So you didn't say anything to me at the time, but you began to watch me. And you decided that because this job that I had was, I was losing it to some degree, and I would need to ask the question, what is God saying to the two of us about what Gail will do next? And you began to observe. And one day you came to me and you said, the next time somebody asks you to go and speak at a retreat, you're going to go and I'm going to watch the children. And I remember you sitting down with me and helping me with a message, showing me how to do it. I mean, I didn't know diddly about putting a message together. And you even gave me some of your best illustrations on that first time.
Now, there is a great biblical example of sacrificial love.
Yes. And as long as I didn't use them within 500 miles of you, it was all right.
It only seems fair.
Yes. But that is what kingdom building in the home is all about. Because if a pastor is going to do all of this discovering of gifts in his congregation, and he hasn't first done it with his wife and his children, always looking to see what's happening. I remember I went on that retreat, and I remember that as I spoke, I had blotches everywhere. I had to manuscript it because I was scared out of my wadden, and shaking all over. But I came home, and I remember thinking, there is a very embryonic gift here. If we fan it, maybe it'll grow.
It was obvious. It didn't take rocket science to see. I remember thinking in those days as I watched you. Let me scroll back there for a moment. It's a pastor's job to help people discover their giftedness, to tease out the potential in each person that he or she comes across. But all too often, we're so busy doing that to the people in the church that we don't look at our own spouse, whom we love the most, and say, what does God want to do through her in coming years? And when you say, the kids don't need me anymore, what you're really saying is, I'm facing the day when, as a mother, I will be forced to retire. And so, you know, it doesn't take a lot of brains to say, what are the next years going to bring? And I watched you in groups when we were in a group, when you spoke, people listened to you. Men listened to you, which was extraordinary because they appreciated some of the wisdom you had. So, why not recognize there's the gift of a teacher here? Let's find out how it can be fanned out. And so I got to the point where it was more joy for me to see you do something like that than what I was doing. It was just great to see how God was developing this new thing in your life that would carry you past the years of mothering.
If I could share the letters with this congregation of ministry people, of the women who have written to me and said, my husband sees me only as somebody who can sit in the nursery or do coffee in the kitchen. And I'm relegated. The only place that I'm valued is in the marketplace. So that's where I've gone. I'm not going to do church anymore. That's what they say. And that breaks my heart because rather than building in this woman's life and letting her flower, which I feel you have allowed me to do, never being jealous of any gift God gave me, but loving it. I think that's so biblical. It's an Aquila-Priscilla marriage.
Well, we've reached a new level of love, haven't we, where each of us desires that the other person reach the fullness of their potential, that they become everything God wants them to be. I remember back somewhere in our engagement, another one of those pieces of advice that someone, I forget who, you know, said to me, your greatest responsibility as a husband is to make sure that your wife becomes every inch the woman God wants her to be. Gosh, you know, that's a heavy.
Well, that's the Ephesians 5 passage, isn't it?
It really is. Christ loved the church and gave himself for it that he may sanctify it or build it up or perfect it, that he might present it to the Father. I don't want to be too sentimental here, but you know, what if when we stand before God, the first thing he says to men and women is, did your spouse become a more godly woman or a more godly man because they married you? That's a profound question. And if we don't have a good answer for that, wow.
Yeah, it's scary.
Now, let's talk about one more gift. And for some people, it's not going to seem in alignment with everything we've talked about. Now we're 25 years into the marriage. And I guess the lesson that has to be learned here is that you can never get to a point in your life where you're impervious to failure. So in a moment that's almost too horrible to describe, or certainly not defensible or excusable, in a moment I break the vows of our marriage. And for a moment, there's something in our relationship which is just a terrible, terrible wound that in many relationships could have been a death blow. And the question is, you know, can we come back from this? Do we lose all those wonderful years in this one terrible choice or one moment? Or can we regain our footing? Can we come back? And a large part of that depends upon you. as to how you're going to react to this moment. And as I came to you and had to face with you what had happened, then the question is there mercy enough in our relationship for this moment? Is there greater mercy than the sin or the darkness which has come into the situation?
And, of course, the answer to that is absolutely, because of the way we've practiced forgiveness for 25 years. If you all of a sudden had asked me to forgive when you hadn't been merciful to me before and built a track record of that, then we might have had a deeper problem. I've heard many women say, if he ever was unfaithful to me, I'm out of here. A lot of women say that. I could never say that because I feel that in many times in my life, in our marriage, I was unfaithful in different ways by my mouth, by anger, different things that I did that I needed to come to the cross for. But your mercy was something that you were first performer in our home. Now it was my opportunity to give back to you the mercy you'd given to the children and I. And then I also think in there, it has so much to do with the depth of repentance. There was so heartbroken you were to have grieved God and me and the body of Christ. How could I not forgive you? I mean, talk about sin. Now that would have been sin.
Well, you know, we're talking 20 years ago. Mm. And how do you describe for people the mystery of what repentance and mercy can achieve in a long-term relationship? Why would anyone, you know, the 25 years of building and building and building, and then to lose it all, but in the mercy, and let's not let anybody get the feeling that that mercy comes instantly and, oh, it's all over with now.
No.
It's a healing process which takes
months
a lot
and
of
years,
time.
Depending on the severity of it.
And there's real grief, and yes, there is a deep anger of the heart that has to be there. It would be abnormal if it wasn't there. But what comes out of this, these ashes, is a new kind of beauty. It's now a relationship which is not just purchased by commitment and devotion at the beginning, but now you've added to that the mix of mercy and grace.
It's got blood in it.
Absolutely. It's got blood in it. And so now the two of you turn at a deeper level. You have a deeper respect for the power of evil. You have a deeper understanding of the meaning of kindness and grace and mercy. You have a deeper love for the relationship and how precious it is, and how you want to just do nothing but feed it with greater and greater depth to it. So now here you are, and here you and I are in our 45th year. And I think it would be very safe to say that we love each other more dearly today than we've ever loved each other before. We have more depth and ability to know each other's hearts. We've gone all the way down the line of those dolls, and there are very few surprises. Doesn't mean we're problem-free, but it means that there's a love there that will take us all the way to the grave.
Yeah, I think we've come to the place where, we'll talk about this at the end today, but where we call it the 20-80 rule, where there's about 20% still that I'm not particularly excited about in your life, but the 80%, but the 80% I love. And too often in relationships we're hung up on the 20%, and when you've been married this long you say, fiddle with the 20%, let's stick with the 80%.
Well, it's time to get some coffee and just kind of rest for a little while. But I guess if there was any question that Gil and I would like to leave with all of you in the end of this session is, have you lately thought about your relationship as a relationship to gift giving? What gifts have you given to each other? And what gifts need to be given? And that provides a lot of talking room for a lot of people. And we hope that you'll take the time to do that. We'll see you in the next session. Thank you.